This is Paul Segrist. We are now resuming the interview. This is tape two of the interview with Kay Sorensen. Mr. Sorensen, you were just sort of telling me about the things that you had to do at Mr. Peterson's boarding establishment. Mm-hmm. Can you talk to me a little bit about Mr. Peterson himself, his background, and what he was like to work for?
Well, I understand that he was a chef. He was a professional chef, and that he had a... one of his jobs was up in Lake George, in some big hotel in Lake George. And that's where he met, he said it was his son, but I understand that he adopted this boy that was supposed to have been his son. His name was Bert Peterson. I think it was Albert, perhaps, but Bert, he was quite a bit younger than Mr. Peterson was up in age at that time. I'm sure he was over 60, 70 years old when he brought me over, and I would say that Bert was probably around 50 years old, you know. But he seemed to know his business about cooking, you know. He really was an excellent cook, and of course his son had worked with him in the hotel, so I mean he was a pretty good cook too, you know. It was a famous place. I mean they had a lot of good people there, a lot of good rumors, and, you know, I remember there was a few law students, and one fella, after he worked, he lived there before I even got there, he lived there as a roomer, but he came back while I was there, and he was a big lawyer in New York City. You know, he had lived there in his younger days when he went to law school. But I don't think Peterson socialized too much. He did have some friends that... came in once in a while to visit, you know, but I don't think he socialized much.
What was your relationship with Peterson like? Was he, did he treat you like staff, or was he perhaps warmer in his...
No, I would say he treated me like an employee. He didn't treat me like one of the family, you know. I was strictly an employee as far as that. And I had to pay, I was getting $5 a week. That was my salary at that time. And $1 was taken out towards my fare for coming over here. And I think I owed him about $150 or something like that, you know. And I kept track of it. And when it was paid up, I said, that's it, you know. And the understanding was that after working for him for a while, he would see that I got a job someplace. Well, it went on, and I didn't get a job. You know, he didn't suggest go getting a job, and I was working, and I had finished school then, you know. And so Don Carr, my friend, and I, on a Sunday afternoon in Washington Park, we met a couple of girls. You know, we got talking to a couple of girls there, and we took them for a boat ride. They have boats on the lake there, you know. We took them for a ride, and we saw them the next Sunday, you know, took them for a ride again, and... got real friendly. As it turned out, later on, I married one of the girls. And she was working in the laundry at the Albany Medical Center, called the Albany Hospital at that time. And Albany Hospital.
Oh, hospital.
Hospital, yeah, okay. So, well, we went pretty steady together. I see her every Sunday, and then... Mr. Peterson had a telephone down in the kitchen, you know, that could go down and use when nobody heard of me or knew about it or anything. So I used to call her a couple of times, you know. So she says, are you going to be a dishwasher all your life, you know? And I got thinking about it. I said, well, no, not really. Now I'm getting to be 18 years old, you know. I said, I ought to start looking for a job. So I went looking for a job. And I found a job working for a contractor. He was building houses up in Pine Hill. And I got a job, 35 cents an hour, working 10 hours a day. But them days, there was no backhoes or anything. You push the dirt out, wheelbarrow, and I'm telling you, after working, washing dishes, and then going into being a laborer like that, it was quite a job, you know? So, but anyway, I moved out of Peterson. I got a room.
So you worked for Peterson 4 years?
4 years, yeah.
Other
no,
immigrants?
No. Well, yes, before me there was another fellow. There had been another fellow that I don't know what arrangement he made with him, but I know there was another fella some years before that had done the same thing that he had brought over from Denmark. And
was Peterson himself a former immigrant?
Or... Oh, yeah. Oh, he was born in Denmark. Yeah.
I see. I wanted to ask you, in those first couple of years when you were first here, was there something that you simply could not get accustomed to in this country? Something that really was hard for you to adjust to, other than the language, which is, you know, an obvious thing.
No, I don't think so. I know you, the way we used to eat in Denmark. You would eat with a fork and a knife, both. You know, and I got accustomed to just using the fork. You cut your meat, lay the knife down, and then just using the fork. I mean, that was something I had to overcome, but I mean, no big problem. No, I don't think I had too much of a problem getting accustomed to it.
Were you instructed at the boarding house how to behave in front of the guests? Were you instructed in protocol of some sort by Peterson, how you had to address guests or...
Oh, no, I had learned that in Denmark, you know. I knew how to handle the guests in Denmark, you know. Being very polite, smile, and, you know. And I think that's what got me too. I'll never forget, though, the day I sailed, my father said to me, remember this. He said, if you smile and laugh, everybody will smile and laugh with you. But if you cry, you cry alone. And I often remember that.
Did, speaking of your dad, did you write back and forth to them?
Did I what?
Write back and forth.
Oh, yes, yes. Even my sister, when I went home, remarked that how faithful I was, and my mother had kept all my letters, postcards and everything I had sent her. Oh, yeah, I was very faithful in writing. Even today, I keep in close contact with my brothers and sister.
Write back to you, your mother or
my
your
mother.
Father?
My mother would write.
What kinds of letters would she write back to you? What sorts of things did she express to you
well,
in those letters?
Well, I would say more or less like an educational kind of thing, you know. Now, she sent me a book in Danish, of course, about... women, you know, about getting married and, you know, something like that. It took me a little bit about...
She was thinking,
yeah.
Did you, in your first couple of years in Albany, did you ever experience any kind of prejudice because you were an immigrant? Do you remember any incident where
I did, but I ignored it. I don't know how many times I was called a squarehead and, you know... Oh, yes, I was on the receiving end of a lot of, you know, oh, yes.
Was there a Danish community in Albany?
No, I never, in 25 years that I was here, I had never, there probably was, but I didn't know about it. I never spoke any Danish, you know, only with Mr. Peterson, he was the only one. And then, of course, my... uncle, as I call him, my mother's cousin, but all the while I was here, I don't think I saw him more than 4 or 5 times. When I got married, I had to get a sponsor because I was only 18 years old. And I knew I couldn't ask Mr. Peterson, you know, so I did contact, my uncle, and he said, well, is that what you want to do? I said, yes. He said, well, you're crazy. I said, well, maybe I'm crazy. But he said, if that's what you want to do, don't, you know, no problem. So he went with me. And then a Danish girl, her family were Danish. And I didn't know that family. That's right. Yeah, I didn't know that family. And they were a Hansen family. And they had
H-A-N-S-E-N,
yeah. And I really don't remember how I got to know him, but... I know there was a bunch of kids my age, you know, boys and girls and stuff. And every once in a while on a Sunday, I would go up there and I would join them for dinner. You know, I was more or less accepted for dinner. But and I thought of her when I wanted to get married, and she was kind enough to stand up with us, you know.
Do you remember ever being very lonely in those first couple of years, regretting that you had made the decision to come?
No, I made up my mind I was never regret it. I would never regret it. I never thought about that. But there was plenty of times when I was lonely. I mean, you know, I was alone. I had no friends for quite a while. I couldn't talk to anybody because I couldn't speak the language. But
Mr. Peterson isn't really a surrogate father. He's basically an employer.
That's right. I mean, we never had any friendly talk or anything like that, you know. I learned very quickly to speak English. I had to.
tell me, when did you get married? What year was it?
I got married in 1927.
And what was your wife's name?
Her name was Elizabeth. They called her Betty. Fivey. F-Y-V-I-E.
F-Y-V-I-E.
She was one of 13 children.
And did you settle in Albany?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Why yeah,
after we got married, we got a room together, jointly, and I don't know, later on, we talked it over, we should get furniture, and, you know, it would be a lot cheaper living in a flat than a room, you know, and back them days, there was no electricity, they had gas lights, you know, and if you sneezed, the damn man out and you had no lights, you know. But anyway, there was a place on Clinton Avenue, there was an outlet for the Salvation Army. And I think for $15, I bought furniture, kitchen set, bedroom, and, you know, whatever, enough to start, you know, furnish an apartment.
Was your wife of immigrant stock?
No. No, she was born here. Both her parents were born in this country, too.
How do you think her parents felt about her marrying a foreigner?
Well, they didn't object. Before we were married, I went up with her a couple of times to visit the family and told them we were going to get married. But of course, the old man, her father, worked in the General Electric. He was a painter in the General Electric, and they had 13 children, and she was about the fourth or fifth child, you know. So, I mean, they had a lot of young kids, and they probably said, why object, you know, it's okay. So we got married.
What did people do in Albany at that time for fun, for entertainment? You were saying you didn't have to work on Sundays. What did you do on Sundays?
Well, at that time, on Sundays, I would take a trolley car and go up to Troy and see the movies because Albany didn't have their movie theaters open on Sundays here. And then we had Mid-City Park in the summertime, which was open, which was an amusement park between Albany and Troy, you know, up in Menands.
Mid-City?
Mid-City Park.
M-I-T-T?
M-I-D City Park.
Mid-City.
Okay. Mid-City Park, Mid-City, yeah. Park. And that was an amusement park, and we used to... in the summertime, we go up there. And then they had a pavilion where they had dances and stuff like that. You know, it was real nice, yeah.
Do you remember who your favorite movie stars were at that time? Or was there someone that you particularly liked to see?
I don't know. I think I was crazy about Gloria Swanson.
tell me a little bit about, kind of progress us through your life. Because I know later you were to join the police force.
Well, that was sometime later, yeah. After we got married, right, December, we got married November 27, and my son was born in December 28, a year and month later. But surprising to me was when my wife said to me, I went to the doctor and... she was pregnant, and I mean, it's so anyway, my son was born, of course, that put a crimp in it, you know. By this time, I had lost my job with the contractor because he didn't work in the wintertime, you know. And I went to the biggest hotel in Albany, the old Ten Eyck Hotel.
Can you spell Ten Eyck, please?
T-E-N-E-Y-C-K. That was the biggest hotel. It was on a chain, you know, of hotels. And I went in there to inquire about a job. And luckily enough, I got a job as a busboy. You know, it didn't pay much money, and I used to get tips from the waiters, and my personality got me through because I was smiling at everybody, and, you know, I mean, I done all right, you know. So that was okay. And the waiter was a Greek, very nice fellow, very, and he took very good care of me. Now, I didn't expect the depression to hit. I went to work there in 1927, in the winter of 1927. And in the meantime, I was there about a year or so, I became a waiter. You know, the head waiter made me a waiter. And then in 1932, the depression hit, and I was laid off. Now, while I worked in the Tenneke Hotel, I became a citizen. I got my citizenship papers. And in fact, the day before I went for my citizenship papers, I waited on the judge that was going to preside. That. So I said to him, I said, I'm going to appear before you tomorrow. He says, yeah, what'd you do? You know, I said, no, I want to become a citizen. Now I had been studying the Constitution and, oh my God, everything. I knew everything. You know, I had read up on it and everything else, expecting to be asked a lot of questions. And I got up before the judge. He addressed me by my name. He said, admit it. Nothing to it. I said, what? I said, great. So I became a citizen. Well, while I was working in the hotel, in the Tenneke Hotel, some of the waiters there, you know, said, you ought to look for a better job where they have a pension system. You know, you're married and you should look to the future. And there's no pension system here, you know. Why don't you apply for the police job? So I said, well, it might be a good idea, you know. So I asked different people, you know, what I should do. And they told me, so I filed an application. That was back in 1931 or 32. Yeah, it was after I became a citizen, because I had to be a citizen to apply for a job.
And you became a citizen in
32. Yeah. So I made out an application for the police, and I took the test. And when the test was published, there had been something like 1,300 applicants, and there were no jobs, you know. And surprising to me, I was number 48 on the list out of all these people, see? Which, you know, I was fine. So anyway, the list was good for 4 years. After 4 years, the list is obsolete again, see? And I had to take the test over again. In the meantime, I got laid off in the Tenneke Hotel. They had a cut down, you know, so I was one of the last waiters, so I got laid off. But the head waiter said, any banquets or anything, you know, special, he said, you're the first one to be called. So, I mean, I didn't worry too much because banquets, you know, I had two or three banquets a week and I was making money. And then I took another job Saturday nights working in a nightclub, which helped, you know. So we done all right.
Did your wife work during the
depression? No, no, no. She was pregnant at the time, so she didn't work. So I remember then I had to get a job. I took a job as a taxi driver. You know, I could work as a taxi driver and work banquets too, you know. So, but I had to get a taxi license from the chief of police. So now I go into the chief of police, apply for a license to drive a taxi. And he asked me a few questions. He says, where's Our Lady of Angels Church? I says, I don't know. He says, where's the Howell Library? I says, I don't know. He says, you want to be a taxi driver and you don't know the city? So he said to me, he says, your size, you ought to be a cop. I says, yeah, what do you have to do? I mean, I said, geez, I got him interested, you know. I said, what do you have to do? He didn't know my application had already been in, you know. So he tells me, he says, who's your ward leader? You know, I said, well, he says, see him. And then he told me the whole thing, you know. I says, oh, great. Now I get outside. He approved me for a taxi license. I get outside and I said, geez, I can't figure that out. I'm too dumb to be a cab driver and he wants me to be a cop. See, So anyway, the second test comes up, see? And I said, geez, I better go and see my friend, the chief. So I went down, asked to see the chief, and I went in and I saw him. I said, I got notified I have to take the test again. Do you have any suggestions? He says, yes. He says, I'll tell you what you do. When you get the questions, answer the ones you know right away. And if there's anything that you don't, you're not sure of, pass it by and answer all the questions that you know, and then go back, go over the questions again, and the ones that you have difficulty with, think about them and then answer them. I said, okay, thank you. You know, so as long as he lived, he thought he was instrumental in me applying for the police job. But I took the second test, and there was only about 900 took it. You know, it was cut down a little bit. But I came out 26th on the list, which was good. And I know there was another Danish, well, he wasn't born in Denmark, but his family was in Denmark. And he said, I can't figure this out. I was born in this country. I graduated from high school, and you got way ahead of me on the list. Now, how come? I said, how the hell do I know, you know? So, but anyway, it was the beginning of the war, the problems in Hitler invading Denmark and all this and that, you know. So I was still working in Keyless. I didn't tell you about getting a job in Keyless. It was a cold day. I'm driving a taxi then, but I felt I would like to get a steady job. So this restaurant, Keyless Restaurant on State Street, was one of the most famous restaurants in all. It was known all over the country. I said, just for the heck of it, I went in and applied for a job. It was cold. I wanted to get warm, you know. So I went in and I asked the head waiter for a job. He said, oh, no. He said, we don't have any changes here. We have the same waiters. And he said, we don't have any jobs. I said, well, okay, thank you. So I started out, and Keeler's son, Gaynor Keeler, was coming down from upstairs, down the stairs, and he saw me. And I happened to have waited on him in the Ten Eyck Hotel in the roof garden, you know, where they dance and all that, you know. And he knew me, you know. And he says, Kay, what are you doing here? I says, well, I'm looking for a job, but there is no job. He said, wait a minute. So he asked the head waiter, he says, now, one of the waiters is out sick, isn't he? He says, yes. How long is he going to be out? He said, well, he didn't know. He says, why don't you put him on the... So the head waiter says, you have to get what they call a monkey jacket. You know, we wore aprons, but you have to get a monkey jacket. I says, yeah, how much do they cost? He said, oh, about $5. I said, well, if I had the $5, I'd go get it. So Gaynor Keeler gave me the $5 to get the jacket. See? And I wanted to pay him back later, but he would never take it. See? So I got the jacket. I'm working there, oh, geez, I think about 6 weeks, almost 2 months, you know. And the waiter comes back. I said, oh, geez, there goes my job, you know. But I didn't know. Gaynor had told the head waiter, you ask some of these waiters to take an extra day off and put him in. She's, so I come in one morning, one of the waiters had died. I said, oh, I got it made. So I worked there until I got appointed to the police.
And what year did you get appointed to the police?
1940.
Before we get too far ahead of ourselves, I believe while you were waiting in the 10-ACK that you have a significant story about waiting on somebody there.
I waited on a lot of famous people. One of the most famous that I think I waited on was Judge Cardoza, who became the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. He was Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in New York State. But he later, I think Franklin Roosevelt appointed him to the Federal Supreme Court. But a lot of other famous people. I waited on the governor at that time was Franklin Delano Roosevelt. I waited on him, Governor Lehman, all those people, a lot of them.
The person that I'm referring to was in the newspaper article that I read that you supplied with your oral history form concerning the gentleman who was shot.
Oh, Dutch Schultz.
I think that would be a good story to tell.
His name was Arthur Fliegenheimer. Okay?
I won't ask you to say.
Okay. Well, he was known as Dutch Schultz, and he was a big beer baron, a gangster from New York City. And he used to peddle booze, and he was brought up to Albany area, for tax evasion charges. And he used to come into Keeler's and eat. Well, for some reason or other, he selected me as his private waiter. Every time he came in, he wouldn't have anybody else wait on him but me. I had to wait on him, see? So he had a lawyer by the name of Dixie Davis. That was his, what he called his mouthpiece, you know, at the time. He was his lawyer. But waiting on him, it appears that he had to have a local lawyer represent him. So they hired a fellow by the name of James Noonan. He was a local attorney. And every day they come in, you know, they go over the defense and, you know, talk about law, and I'd be weighed on them and everything like that. And so one day, there were three or four of them, and he pays his check with a brand new $100 bill. So anyway, his bodyguard, who was well known, Bo Weinberg, they called him, and he supposedly wound up in the East River in a cement box or something like that, you know. So anyway, Bo comes in, and Dutch Schultz says, give him anything he wants. So all right, so I waited on him, and his check at that time came to about $3, you know. So I gave it to Dutch Schultz. He gives me a brand new $100 bill again. And I said to him, I said, gee, why give me a $100 bill? I just gave you about $80 in change. He says, go on, take it. I make it myself. Well, I didn't know whether to believe him or not, you know. Well, I remember one night there was a question of law came up. And Jim Noonan said to Dutch Schultz, the only man I know who can answer that question is Judge Pryor. Well, Judge Dan Pryor was a famous criminal lawyer at that time. So he just called him. So they called Dan Pryor, and Jim Noonan said to me, he said, Dan Pryor will be coming. This was upstairs. Dan Pryor will be coming. Will you bring him up? I says, yeah. So anyway, Dan Pryor comes, and I said, right up this way, Judge. And he said, no, come here. So I said, went down. He says, you tell Jim Noonan I want $500 before I come upstairs. I says, okay, no problem, you know. So I went in and I told Jim Noonan, I says, Judge Pryor is here, but he wants $500 before he comes in. So Dutch says, okay, one, two, three, four, five, brand new $100 bills. So the judge came up, and I don't think he was in there 5 minutes, and he left. I says, boy, what a racket, you know. But then, one Saturday afternoon, Bo Weinberg is there and two strangers, and there's a guy, let me see if I can remember, Jules Martin his name was. He was from New York City, and he owed Dutch Schultz money or something. You know, he was brought up to Albany, and the poor guy had a slipper on one foot. He had an injury to his one foot, and he walked with a cane, you know. So I came in and I waited on them, the four of them. And I remember one of them saying to this Jules Martin, I says, why don't you eat anything you want? You never know when it's going to be your last meal, you know. I mean, they're kidding the guy. So this is Saturday afternoon. Now I waited on them. They're on their way, you know. Sunday paper comes. Well, there wasn't too much business in upstairs in Keeler on Sunday, so I'm reading the paper. And all of a sudden, I see a body found outside of Troy with a bedroom slipper and a cane. I mean, oh, my God. I said, gee, I didn't tell anybody. I says, I'm not going to say anything to anybody. You know, that's a guy I just waited on, you know. So anyway, the state police came in a few days later inquiring about any, if anybody knew, had waited on him, you know. I don't know nothing, you know. Now, a couple of days later, they're back again, see. They said, come here. The fellow that was killed, right? I said, yeah, what about him? He says, he had a veal cutlet, tomato sauce, spinach, french fried potatoes, and you're the only one served a veal cutlet that day. Holy Christ, you know? So I said, they got me, you know? Well, I don't know how many times, believe me, that they picked me up all different hours of day and night, brought me up to Troy, take a look at this guy, take a look at this guy. The state police picked them up. No, I couldn't. I could identify them, but they weren't the ones that they had, you know. So anyway, later on, I get subpoenaed to appear before the grand jury in this murder case in Troy. Now, Jim Noonan, Dutch Schultz's local lawyer, calls Keyless and asks him to send me over to his office. So I go over to his office. He says, I heard you're going to be subpoenaed before the grand jury in Troy. I says, yeah, that's right. He says, what do you know? I says, I know, I don't know nothing. He says, well, just make sure you don't know nothing. So I really got scared, you know? So I told my wife, I said, she had an uncle up in Camden, New York. I said, why don't we take a vacation? Let's get the hell out of town. Because every time I saw a limousine go by, I expected the machine gun to come out, you know? So we took a week's vacation and things cooled off. But anyway, I went up to testify before the grand jury in Troy. They picked me up in a taxi. They come in at noontime, busy waiting on people. Take that apron off and come on, you know, just like that. So I go up to Troy, and Charles Ranney was the district attorney at the time. Charles Ranney, R-A-N-N-E-Y. He was the district attorney. And he says, now I want you to go in and tell what you know. I said, okay. So we're all sitting in a room, and one of the fellas that was there to testify also was Dixie Davis, his lawyer, you know. And he had a habit of twisting a chain around his finger like this, you know. He says to me, how's everything doing in Keyless? I says, oh, okay, you know. But there was another fella there, and he was brought in by an inspector from New York City Police Department, and his name was Marty Crumpier. See, he was a gangster in New York, and he had been shot at two or three times, I found out later, in New York. So the inspector, yeah, what was it? His name was Grafnecker. He said to Marty Crumpier, he says, now, when you get in there, you tell him the truth. And he said to me later, you know, I told him I was going to be a policeman, you know, I was on the list for policemen, and, you know, so I got friendly with him. In fact, later on, I visited him down in New York City, you know, he took me around headquarters and stuff like that after I became a policeman. But anyway, after Crumpier came out, Grafnecker says to him, he says, did you tell him the truth? He says, I told him my name and address. Now, Charlie Ranney come to me. He says, Kay, when you leave here, there's a taxi waiting for you outside. Go out, get right in the taxi. There's reporters, photographers. They're going to take your picture. Don't stop. Don't say a thing to them. I says, okay, you know. Now, I'm going out of the courtroom, and I'm taking my hat to put it on. See, just as they snapped my picture, hiding my face, you know. And Charlie Mooney was there, was a big reporter from the Knickerbocker Press at the time. And I knew Charlie Mooney. I waited on him a half a dozen times. But he had, at that time, had a mental blackout, he told me later. He couldn't recognize me for some reason or other. He didn't see me with an apron on, you know. So he didn't recognize me. And I got by him, see. So anyway, when the paper came out, big headline paper, mystery witness, I'm the mystery, testifies before the grand jury, and it shows me with the, you know, hiding my face. So later on, it was, oh, I was on the police about 10 years when Charlie Mooney, reminiscing, finally revealed in one of his stories in the paper who the mystery witness was, see? And, of course, the next day he knew because he went by Keels and he saw me standing in there, you know. But he says, you know, Kay, he said it made a better story. The, you know, the mystery witness. So.
You know, we're laughing and smiling, and you're smiling and telling me this story, but I mean, this is really kind of frightening stuff, isn't it?
It sure is. I'm telling you, the sweat ran down my back there a couple of times because they knocked these guys off like nothing, you know. And here I could put the finger on the two guys that, you know, that killed him. Obviously, you know. Of course, later on, before the grand jury, I never did agree with Charlie Ranney. Charlie Ranney said that Dutch Schultz killed Jules Martin in a hotel in Cohoes. I mean, that was, so what the hell, what's the difference? They settled the case, you know, it's out again, what's the difference, you know? But I know damn well he didn't, because the same two guys that was in for lunch, about 11 o'clock that night, Dutch Schultz was in the room with Dixie Davis and Jim Noonan. He was very nervous. I remember waiting on him, and these two guys came in, and Dutch Schultz handed each one of them an envelope, and I remember one guy say, "Is it all there?" And the guy, and Dutch Schultz says, "It is." And the guy says, "It better be." And they walked out. But I mean, who the hell would believe you? You know.
It's an amazing.
Yeah,
story.
I know. I mean.
And then the irony that you would later become a police officer.
Well, that's it. Sure.
We need to sort of progress here. Tell me, just sort of in a nutshell, about your police career. How long you were in the force, and
okay. Well, let me tell you. If we're reaching a point, the list lasted 4 years, and the 4 years were just about ready to give up. See, then the war had started. You know, in 39 in over in Europe and everything else, and things were a little rough at the time. So I came. Oh, by this time my wife had died. Well, being a waiter, I had to work Christmas and holidays and New Year's, and I worked New Year's Eve, and at that time, she had two children, right? And she says, "I'm not going to stay home New Year's Eve alone. I'm going up with my family." I says, "Well, why don't you stay?" She was expecting a third child at the time, see? I said, "Why don't you?" No, I didn't know she was going away. She left me a note. I came home early New Year's Day, and I found the note. She had gone up to visit a family in Schenectady. See? Well, we had a snowstorm, and she had to walk about a mile from the trolley car to her parents' home, carrying two kids. You know, one, well, the boy was able to walk, but the girl she was carrying. And she fell in the snow, got all wet and everything else. She came back a couple of days after New Year's. She came back, and she had an awful cold. And there was a nurse living in the same house where we lived at that time on New Scotland Avenue. And I asked the nurse to come in and look at her. And she says, "Kay, you better get her to the hospital, you know." So I sent her up to the Albany Hospital. And the 9th of January, she died of lobar pneumonia. There was nothing. They didn't have the antibiotics them days that they have today.
What was the kind of pneumonia?
Lobar pneumonia, that's what they called it. I don't know what it was, but anyway. And of course, the baby she was carrying, which was about maybe 5 or 6 months, baby died too.
You know. Is January 9th of what year?
1935. Yeah, 1935 she died. And that created another problem because I had to provide for the kids, see? Well, I had a very good neighbor. She had half a dozen kids of her own, but she was good enough to take care of the kids, you know, for a few days. And I thought her mother would take him, but her mother wouldn't, no part of him, she wouldn't take him. So I finally arranged to get him into a Protestant home. And they were both baptized Catholics, you know, but of course it didn't make any difference because my wife didn't live up to the Catholic. We joined the Protestant church, you know, at the time the kids were going to Sunday school and everything, you know, so I didn't think it made any difference. So I get him in the Protestant home, they were in there a couple of weeks, and the grandmother, my wife's mother, come down to the home and raised particularly hell, said the kid didn't belong there because they were baptized Catholics. The home contacted me, said I had to get him out of there. So I said, Jesus, that created another problem. But anyway, my wife's twin brother, she was a twin also, my wife's twin brother and his wife felt sorry for the little girl. My daughter was a little blonde, you know, cute little girl. Decided to take her, but nobody would take my boy. He was a regular boy, you know what I mean? Jesus. So nobody would take him. So I finally got him into a Catholic home, St. Coleman's in Waterleet, and he was up there. So three or four months later, some of my friends says, "We're going to give him a little party, want you to come, see?" Well, the purpose was they were going to introduce me to a girl, you know, but I didn't appreciate the girl that they had picked out for me, see? But there was another girl there with a boyfriend, you know? I said, she really looked, you know? So I got her name, her telephone number, and I called her, and we made a date. And as it turned out, we got married, you know? But on Sundays, every Sunday, I would go up to visit my son up in St. Coleman's, and I would bring my girlfriend with me, you know? And she fell in love with him. So now we plan on getting married in June of 1936, see? My wife died January 35, and we were going to get married June 1930. But it was her birthday. We were out celebrating her birthday the 7th of February, 1936. And she says, what do you say we get married now? I said, you're kidding. No. Okay, so let's get married. Well, I had to go to a Catholic church. She wanted to get married in the Catholic church. She was a Catholic. And I had to take instructions from the priest, right? Well, that was all right. She was 18 years old, and by this time, I don't know, 27, I think, yeah, 27, yeah, something like that. So anyway, that was all right. But her family didn't go along with it. They didn't want her to get married, see? Now, the night we got the best man there and the bridesmaid, we're waiting at her grandmother's house, ready to go to church. Her mother let me borrow her car, you know, for the to get married, you know. And her uncle is there. He was a policeman, and he's on his way to work. And he stopped in, and he says to my girlfriend at the time, he says, Mill, he says, you don't have to go through with this now. It's not too late to drop out. Right in front of me, you know. But she didn't. She said, no, I'm going to get married.
What was her name?
Mildred Belleville. B-E-L-L-V-I-L-L-E. Mildred Belleville. And so we got married. The next day, we went to St. Coleman's and picked my son up. We went up to Schenectady to pick my daughter up. And the first day of our marriage, she had two children.
The 1930s were very difficult years for you.
They were. Yeah, they really were. And I never, all these problems, I never once mentioned it to my family in Denmark. Never.
Did they know that you had been married?
Oh, yeah, they knew I was married. Oh, sure, they knew I was married.
But the hardship that you had gone through.
No, they never knew about that.
Was it sad for you that your parents had never gotten a chance to meet your first wife?
Well, no, I don't know, no.
That never occurred to you?
No. Of course, they met my second wife. I brought her to Denmark a couple of times.
In our few remaining minutes here, perhaps talk a little bit for maybe 5 minutes or so about your police career.
Well, I would say I probably had 95% luck and 5% efficiency, you know, because it seemed no matter where I went in, I was lucky. I was doing a good job, you know. And
did you enjoy this work?
Yeah, I enjoyed it. At the time, there wasn't enough hours in a day for me because I really enjoyed being policeman and helping people and stuff like that. And I made some good arrests as a patrolman. And one time we got my partner and I captured three kids that broke away from an industrial school. And chasing them, my partner fired a shot over the car to bring it to a halt. And we pick them up. And I frisked the guy to see if he had anything I wanted. The biggest guy, you know, who was 16 years old at the time. And he had two candy bars, a flat candy bar and a tall, and it felt to me like an automatic pistol in his pocket, you know, and it's been old. But anyway, it was two candy bars, see. Now, the next day, I take him down to court, and I'm riding in a wagon with him. And the kid said to me, he says, listen, copper, I'm going to come back. But he says, the next time, I'll do the shooting first. I made the mistake of telling my wife. And the bum escaped a few years later. And all she could think of, oh, my God, he come back to kill my husband, you know. But, of course, he didn't. And eventually he got out, and I talked with him, and we more or less became friends, you know. I mean, but that was exciting. And then it was funny. I went to the Tenneck Hotel where I used to work with my wife and I. We went to the show. We stopped in there to visit some of the old friends. I got a drink. And the bartender said to me, why don't you come down to the second precinct downtown? I said, Tony, I'm lucky I'm on the police, you know, never mind trying to get down to say. Well, he said, wouldn't you like to come down to second precinct? I said, sure, everybody would like to come down to downtown precinct. Well, yeah, sure I would. 2 weeks later, I come into work one afternoon, and the sergeant said to me, he said, what's the matter? Don't you like it here? I said, yes, I like it here. He said, look at this. So I looked at it. An order, the chief ordering me transferred from the 5th precinct to the 2nd precinct. I said, geez, that's pretty good. A bartender got me transferred down to the 2nd precinct. And I was down the 2nd precinct, and the first couple of months I was in on I think, 8 manslaughter cases. There was 3 people burned to death. Somebody had set the fire. Somebody else killed. Oh, what a place. I mean, you know.
How did your parents feel about this very different kind of career that you decided? I mean, what was your
I don't think I told them too much about it. I mean, they knew I was a policeman, you know. And I got promoted to plain clothes. Now, I don't know. Apparently, all the notoriety, my name got in the paper, you know, and I made good arrests and everything else. So anyway, one day a detective come over. I'm sitting there playing cards just before going on duty. And he come over and said to me, he says, "Can I see you a minute?" I says, "Yeah, sure." He says, "Doc wants to know if you want to take the plain clothes job." I said, "Who the hell is Doc?" You know, I didn't. He said, "That's what they call the chief." I said to myself, I said, "Well, I'll think it over." He says, "You don't have time to think it over." Then I said, "Geez, if they offer you something, I suppose I better take it, you know." I said, "Yeah, okay, tell them I'll take it." The next day, I'm transferred to another precinct in plain clothes. Again, I solve a big burglary, you know. There were a lot of musical instruments stolen and everything. I got them all back and, you know, my name getting the paper and all of that. The first thing you know, I was promoted to detective, see? Very short while, you know. So now I work as a detective, and that was when I first went back to Denmark. 1948, I was promoted to detective, and a couple of months after that, I got a letter from my mother saying that my father had a heart attack, they would like to have me come home, you know. So I cashed in an insurance policy, and my wife borrowed money, and I was able to go pay for my fare over. And my mother's brother-in-law at that time, he paid my fare one way, you know, so I was able to go over.
What was it like seeing your mother for the first time in all?
In 25 years. I mean, what a fantastic party they gave me. They got the whole family together. And, I couldn't talk to her. I couldn't understand Danish. It was difficult. I forgot the Danish, you know, but eventually it came back, you know, I could understand. So now I just went over last year and I could get by, you know, I could understand and get by. But then what happens, I'm back here 2 months in 1948 after visiting my family for the first time in 25 years. I got word my mother had suddenly died. And I was tickled at that. And my father lived on. He died in 1962, I think.
So, you know, you had actually gotten a chance to see her.
Yeah, before. I saw her before she died, yeah.
When did you retire from the police force?
I retired the first day of January 1976, after 36 years. I got appointed June the 27th, 1940. And then, of course, I was a detective, you know, so long, and I'm watching fellas that joined the police at the same time wind up lieutenants, captain. I'm staying here. I'm a detective, you know. So I said to my partner, who was also a detective, I says, "I'm going to take the sergeant's test when it comes up." He says, "Maybe they don't want you to." I said, "The hell with them. I'm going to take it, you know." So I took the sergeant's examination, and I come out, I don't know, one or two or three on the list, you know, right? And I'm going to be appointed. And it was right near Christmas time. And I didn't do too bad around Christmas in the detective office, you know. So I said, "Geez, I don't want the job." So I asked the chief, I said, "What can I do to pass it up?" He says, "You have to write a letter to the commissioner." So I wrote a letter to family problems and stuff like that. I declined the appointment. So I didn't take the appointment, right? Well, another vacancy came up short while after that. I declined that, see. Then the chief said to me, he said, "The next time there's a vacancy, either you take it or you're off the list." I says, "Okay." There wasn't going to be a vacancy for months, you know, so I didn't care. Jesus, one Thursday afternoon, one of the new sergeants went over to the chief, puts a gun on the desk and the shield. He says, "You better take this before I shoot myself." He had a nervous breakdown. That was Thursday. Friday, I'm sworn in as a sergeant. Saturday, I go to work. I didn't have a chance to turn it down. So now I'm a sergeant, back in uniform, working around the clock.
What year is this?
56. I went back as a sergeant. And So, of course, that didn't set so good with my wife, you know, because I was taking her to work every day and picking her up every night. Now I'm working around the clock. I couldn't do that, you know. And it meant losing money because I, as a sergeant, as a detective, I was getting clothing allowance. I didn't pay, I have to pay tax on. But as a sergeant, I got more money, a higher tax bracket, and I paid higher tax. See? Well, I was a sergeant for 2 years, and then I could take the lieutenant's exam. I took the lieutenant's exam. I come out number one, and I was appointed lieutenant. Then I stayed lieutenant for a long time. I said, holy crap. It was 1969 when we had, there was riots all over the country. We had a disturbance here, and everybody is hollering about the getting somebody to intercede between the public and the police. And so one day the chief says to me, he says, stop up in the office, I want to talk to you. So I went up to the office and he says, the mayor wants to organize a community relations unit and he thinks you're the one that can do it. So I said, geez, that's a pretty good opportunity. I says, yeah, I'll take it, providing he makes me a captain. Oh, no, the chief said. I said, well, then I'm not interested. And I walked out. 2 days later, I made a captain. So I organized the community relations unit.
That's quite something, you know, from a kid from Denmark, you know, who worked
Well,
summer jobs in.
Paul, let me tell you, a lot of people have said to me, how did you do it? Well, the only thing I can say, the reason was I was cordial to people. I was nice to people. I done everything I could for them, and, you know, and one, I mean, I didn't have to ask for favors. They would go out, you know. I mean, I don't know, my attitude or something, you know.
What do you think has remained Danish about you through your whole life to this day?
Well, I've always been proud of being Danish. Always been proud. And I have a granddaughter, the one that's into genealogy. She's very proud of it. In fact, she wrote me a letter I got a couple of weeks ago, and she said, did you know that during the war, when Hitler invaded Denmark, that Hitler ordered all Jews in Denmark to wear the Star of David, and that the king ordered all Danes to wear the Star of David? And I said, yes, I knew it. Yes.
I hope your granddaughter is happy with the tape. I hope that
Well, Paul, I hope you get me that tape because
yeah, it'll take a while
well,
before
I
I
mean
do it, but I'll
that's
definitely.
okay. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
My final question to you is this. I think I know the answer already, but are you glad that you made this decision to come here?
I've never been sorry. I've never, it was a decision I made, and I said, damn it, I'm going to abide by it. I'm going to stick it out. And there was plenty of times, I mean, when I was left with those two small children all alone, nobody to turn to, I said, what the hell do? I got to do something. But I fought it, and, you know. Oh, I admit there was some sad times, but I would never have had the opportunity to get this far in Denmark, I don't think.
You
Now,
have been a
my
mechanic.
brother went up to, went on to be a mechanic, and he wound up one of the biggest automobile dealers in Denmark. Sold new cars. He came over here, and I said to him, I said, I get a new car every 2 years. He says, yeah, I get two cars every year.
Chances are you're so enterprising and so affable that you would have been successful no matter where you
Well,
stayed.
it's possible. It's possible. I mean, now, I don't know. I'll tell you a little incident that happened in Keeler's. The head waiter was away from the front of the room, the dining room, see? And there's waiters, every three tables, there's a waiter standing. One night, a colored man came in the door. All the waiters turned their head, and I stepped out, right here, sir, right here. You know, sat him down. And he was the most interesting individual I ever talked to. He was a doctor from India and was over here to give a lecture to a medical college in Chicago. And then back them days, a 25-cent tip was a big tip, you know. He gave me a dollar, and I left it laying on the plate. But I mean, it didn't hurt me. I mean, you know, I'm not that prejudiced.
Well, you came from a society that didn't have that kind of prejudice. I mean, as you said, you never saw a black person.
I know
before.
It. No,
so
no.
So you didn't have that ingrained sense of
no,
of
no. I didn't.
Well, I want to thank you very much for letting me come out here.
Is it the end of the day? Is it all over?
Almost 2 hours.
Well.
Do you have a final statement, perhaps, that you'd like to make of some sort?
Well,
I sign off.
I'll tell you one thing. The fellow that I got to work with me in community relations was a black fellow. The first black policeman I ever had. And I said to John Dale, he's now the chief of police here. I said to John, there's going to be a lot of problems you're not going to like. There's going to be a lot of things you're going to see you're not going to like. There's going to be a lot of things you're going to hear you're not going to like. But if you can learn to overcome it, you'll be a good policeman. And he was. And he and I worked together in a community relations unit. And Father Young in Albany invited us down to a breakfast one Saturday morning, I think it was. And Father Young and I was the only two white people in the place. There was about 20 black ministers from the area, you know, all black. And I'm sitting alongside of John. Now, I worked with John for a good many years, and I never gave it a thought. I leaned over to John, and I said, John, are we ever outnumbered here? And he turned around, Captain, what do you mean we? You know? And one night a colored woman came in. She was beat up with two small children, complaining about her man had beat her up. See, I said, "Well, do you have some place else to go?" She said, "Yes, but I don't have any money." I called a prowl car in. I said, "Take this woman and her two children up there." And when she didn't hear him, he said to me, he says, when am I running taxi for niggers? I said, right now you are. But I mean, you know, there's always going to be prejudices, and it's unfortunate. It's very unfortunate. I've got a lot of friends. In fact, I argue with a black professor from the state university. It so happened that two detectives stopped the cab driver one night, and they were watching a couple of dope peddlers, two black guys, you know. And they went up to the cab driver and says, and one of them said to him, where'd you take them spooks to? See? Well, he complained to this professor, and oh my God, letters. He wanted the two guys fired, letters between him and I, and oh my God, trying to save the jobs for him. But you know.
Well, of course, as an immigrant, you might have experienced, you might have been on the receiving end of
that's
similar
right.
kind of prejudice.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, anyway, I want to thank you again for having me come out to your house and for conducting this interview with you for the History Project.
I really enjoyed it. I mean, it's going to please my daughter no end because she's been after me.
Good.
I don't know whether you would want to take it or
yes,
not.
Yes, we'll take a look at that in just a moment.
Oh, okay.
This is Paul Segrist signing off with Kay Sorensen in Albany in upstate New York.